2 weeks ago was the last time I spoke here. That was just around the time that the people were learning about the earthquake in Indonesia. I don't think I heard about it until after the talk. I'm not sure exactly when I learned about it first. I went off on retreat that day and taught a retreat for 7 days. Most of the people in the retreat were kind of like me. They just had begun to learn wind of what had happened. Then they went into silence and they didn't read papers or watch television or anything for the week. Those of us who were teachers of the retreat, we tracked the news and learning as the days went along the magnitude of what had happened there. One of the issues that teachers on retreat have to face occasionally is it necessary to tell people in retreat when there's been some major event in the world? And I know sometimes at the 3-month retreat when there's a presidential election, they'll put a little note on the bulletin board that's folded down. And so no announcement is made about who won the election, but if you really need to know, you can lift up that piece of paper and find out. There was some mention of it during the week that some people heard. But then at the end of the week, so a week ago Sunday, end of the retreat, the teachers had to find some way to tell people on the retreat what had happened, and so that they wouldn't just leave the retreat last Sunday and face the full magnitude of the news. And our thoughts on the retreat was that people leaving retreat are much more open or vulnerable, sensitive than often people are just kind of normal life. And to read some of these stories and to be impacted by it would have been quite overwhelming for some of them. As it was for people who were not on retreat. And I know that people, there are people who have, you know, read accounts in the newspaper and watched accounts on television and cried at what they encountered with the earthquake and the tsunami. I know at Spirit Rock, during the week we were there, there was a lot of anxiety among the staff there about individuals, staff persons, the people we knew who were in India at that time and wanting to know if they're okay. And there was emails and telephone calls going out to different agencies to see if they can be tracked and found. And one of them, in fact, Franz, who some of you maybe have encountered on retreat, he's been a manager on retreats and also now teaches Qigong at many Vipassana retreats. He was on the beach in India when the earthquake hit. He was doing Qigong. And he saw it coming and he ran, jumped up into a wall and then up into a tree and held on as the wave went over him. And he just sent a very brief kind of telegraph kind of email message about his experience. And he said that his mind got very clear in that process. And then there was another little telegraph part of the, you know, little phrase of his email that said something like, so many deaths, dot, 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 dot. So, you know, we don't know exactly what he saw and what he experienced around him, but certainly you can imagine. And so last week, you know, the teacher had to consider how to relate the events to the people leaving the retreat. And also this week, it's been on my mind how to bring the topic up here on Sunday morning. And many people will go to their place of their spiritual center, their religious location, for some kind of way of processing or dealing or some kind of way of responding to this kind of event in their lives. And, you know, it's I think something of this magnitude touches the very deepest cores in people's lives. And so when something goes that deep in us, then people will turn towards spirituality, religion, as one of the ways to somehow understand or find meaning or find a way of coping or relating to something like this. There hasn't been a shortage of people who have been angry or have wondered, you know, why has this happened? Why, you know, so for example, people who are theists, why has God allowed this to happen? And so people, and that's kind of periodically in the history of humanity, when there's been big tragedies, people have kind of been angry at God or had to struggle with, you know, with God and why this might happen. Buddhists certainly have their own attempts to try to explain why. You find some Sri Lankan Buddhists or some Buddhists around who attribute everything to karma. And so there's an explanation. This is why it happens. It's the karma. But that sometimes that just doesn't work for people, you know, in this kind of magnitude of problems. You know, this is karma that all these children were washed out to sea, and you know, what's going on here? So the question is, so some people coming here, you know, to IMC or coming to Buddhism, what does Buddhism have to offer in this kind of context? And what does it have to say that's helpful, that helps people? I read one account of newspaper article that I found somewhere that a somewhat famous scholar of Theravada Buddhism named Charlie Halisi was responding to this crisis, and he was quoted in the article, and he said, well, the article had a lot to do with how Sri Lankans were responding to the tragedy or dealing with it. And he said something, well, you know, in this magnitude of this kind of difficulty, the Eightfold Path doesn't seem to offer much guidance, much help. And that kind of struck me as a pretty powerful statement from a scholar of Theravadan Buddhism. And as if Theravadan Buddhism or Buddhism doesn't have the resources somehow to help us meet and respond to the tragedies. So I was surprised by that, and I somewhat disagree with him. I think that any spiritual tradition that's going to be worthwhile has to be able to help us at whatever human experience that we're going to encounter, however deep it might be or however tragic it might be. And that if it can't help us in times of greatest tragedy, then it's probably not worth its salt. If it's only about, you know, calm and bliss and light and you know, harmony all the time, then maybe it's, you know, I don't know if it really is realistic. In the Buddhist tradition, in this Theravada tradition, there's a word, Pali word, that's vega, V-E-G-A. And vega means, comes from the root to tremble. And it also has the meaning of a force or impulse or speed, to tremble with force, perhaps. And depending on its the prefix of the word, it has different meanings. Different meanings with different prefixes primarily refer to ways in which we tremble or we're moved or stirred inside by our encounter with the world around us or experiences. And it's said that when the Buddha, for the first time in his life, it's kind of a strange story, but when he was 29, when it was said the first time that he maybe really, in some really profound way, existential way, encountered sickness, old age, and death. Until then, he'd been protected from it. That he was stirred in a very profound way. His heart trembled and moved. And that stirring of his heart was called samvega, with the prefix sam. And this is, he was stirred with a sense of urgency and force around religious practice, spiritual practice, to follow and look for some kind of response to the suffering that he perceived in greed, hate, and delusion. And this word samvega has become a very important word in the Theravada tradition, the Buddhist tradition, sometimes translated as spiritual urgency, that somehow the contact with the tragedies of life, the difficulties of life, is one of the places, one of the ways that a person can be motivated down to the very, you know, core of their being to engage in the kind of spiritual life, spiritual practice. Another word with vega at its root is ubbega. It's kind of the V becomes a B in this kind of, when you put a U in front of it, but ubbega. And ubbega can have two different meanings depending on the context. And one meaning, it means anxiety or anguish or fright. And so it's a kind of trembling or shaking or being stirred with anxiety and fear. The other meaning, in different contexts, means, translated into English, is uplifting rapture. So kind of a rapture or bliss or joy that somehow pervades and penetrates the whole being. It's very subtle and very satisfying. People feel like almost like their body's being lifted up into the air, like they can fly or something. That kind of joy and rapture, that kind of stirring of the heart. So depending on how, so things happen in the world, and it can stir our hearts in different ways. And part of, I think, of any kind of mindfulness life, life that's based on mindfulness, is a willingness to allow the world to stir our hearts. If we allow it to stir our hearts, then if we allow it to stir our hearts into joy, uplifting joy, it requires us to have the same kind of openness that would allow us to be impacted in some way, to be trembled, to be moved in the context, in very deep ways, in the context of tragedy. The capacity to be open, in a sense, is what's required for joy. It's also what's, but also it's what's required of what makes possible the kind of deep compassionate steering or sense of urgency or sense of impulse and motivation that can come when we encounter tragedy. And that openness at times can also lead to anxiety and to fear and distress. So is it just a matter of chance which you get? You know, if you encounter tragedy, it's just a matter of chance that some of us feel fear and anxiety and some of us feel some other very different emotion called samvega. Samvega is considered a very healthy emotion in Theravada and Buddhism. It's considered very appropriate to have, and it's a source of spiritual motivation. And I would argue that it's not a matter of chance, but it has a lot to do with how well we've practiced, how well we've worked on ourselves, understand ourselves, how we respond to different situations. One of the American Vipassana teachers, Steve Smith, was in Thailand at the time of the earthquake. I don't know his story. I don't know where he was. But he teaches a retreat, apparently, every year in a place on the beach in Thailand, a place that was devastated. And I don't know if he was there at the time or if he went there afterwards, but many of his people, he knew there, he kind of tends to get involved with the local community wherever he is, and so people supported the retreat perhaps. And many of the people that he knew, he calls his friends, died in the tsunami. So his response was to go down there and help. Another friend, a woman here that we know, that some of us talked for us here, named Rana Kabatsnik, was in Thailand practicing there. And her response also was to go down to the beaches and to help with what was going on. So she was deep. These people are deeply stirred, and that stirring of them led them to go down and try to offer help, to do something about it. And I think this idea of samvega, this allowing ourselves to be moved, allowing ourselves to let it come into us, then gives motivation. Gives birth to motivation that requires us to act in some way or other. And the stronger the impact, the stronger the force of the tragedy, the more important it is for the heart to respond and act in some way. And if we don't act, then I think we do kind of violence to our own hearts. It's the nature of the human heart, is my sense, to respond. If someone trips next to you as you're walking down the sidewalk, I think it's human nature, even without thinking about it, to offer your hand to help them up. And depending on the scale and magnitude of the difficulty, the heart, an open heart will respond. And so how is it going to respond? What are the ways of responding? I like to think that there's two primary directions of the response. There's a response which is external and the response which is internal. Traditionally in Buddhism, the internal response is what is pointed to by this word samvega. The internal response in the sense that the inspiration to practice, to clarify the roots of suffering, the roots of the existential issues in oneself. Certainly major challenges and tragedies in human lives can be a tremendous source for people to want to clarify their spiritual life, to really go take the spiritual life to its depth of possibility. It's been pointed out by some people that some of the great religious leaders of humanity had lost one or both of their parents when they were still children. And perhaps that kind of loss is, you know, one of the things that gives them the kind of impulse, the power, the strength, or the motivation to really follow through all the way to what's possible in a spiritual life. If everything's kind of comfortable in our life, then perhaps there's not going to be the motivation there. I have teachers who are Vipassana teachers in Hawaii, and I've been told by them, by a number of them, that they'll offer one-day retreats in Hawaii and nobody comes, or very few people come, because you could always go to the beach. And so if you're a little bit off or suffering, you know, you go to the beach, and the beach helps a lot. Is that right, Richard? Is it kind of like that there? He had to come to California to practice. Sorry. And in Hawaii, a lot of people came last Sunday. Yeah, I can imagine. After a week after the earthquake, people come. Especially, you know, you don't want to go to the beach then. Last week, my son has a subscription to a magazine called Cricket, a little kids magazine. And so the magazine comes, and my son is all excited when it comes, and my wife has sat down on the couch to read his magazine. And coincidentally, the magazine was all about the beach and the tide pools and the waves coming in and coming out. And my wife had a hard time reading it to my son because, you know. And so then, you know, to be motivated. And so there's a story or a teaching that the Buddha gave about the four thoroughbreds, four horses. And one kind of horse is the kind of horse that sees just the shadow of the whip of the rider and will, you know, do whatever it's told to do or ride fast. Another one has to actually feel the whip lightly touching the skin and then will take off. Another horse that's not so well trained, perhaps, has to actually feel a little sting against in the skin in order to be able to take off. And the fourth kind of horse is the kind of horse that really needs to be struck hard and has to, the sting has to go penetrate down into the bones for it to really want to take off. And so that's supposed to be an analogy for four kinds of people. And the Buddha said, some people hear about, in a distant village, someone has gotten sick and died. And just hearing about that stirs them to such a strength that they're motivated to penetrate the deepest truths in themselves, deepest spiritual, or attain the highest level of spiritual realization. And that's like the person, that's like the horse who just sees a shadow of the whip. Other people have to go to another village and visit people they don't know, see people, but see someone who's sick and someone who's dying. And that's, you know, gets them serious about life. Life is a serious matter. Let's not waste any time here. Someone else, it has to be someone in their own village, someone in their own family, perhaps, who has to get sick and die before they feel, oh, this is, you know, I can't waste my time here. I have to get serious. And then the fourth kind of person is a person who has to get sick and start dying themselves before they finally kind of can wake up and get serious. I think I got to, you know, buckle down here and try to do something about this life of mine. So one of the ways of being impacted by tragedy is to allow the fullness of it, the depth of it, to fuel a spiritual life. And I think I know a lot of people for whom the motivation for dedicating their whole lives to practice is because of the suffering they see in the world, and they feel that the practice is one of the ways to respond to suffering, one of the ways to offer help to the world around. So in my own situation, I spent a lot of time when I was young trying to decide how I was going to respond to the suffering of the world. And it was something that's what seemed to be what I wanted to do with my life. It just didn't seem to be any other thing to do. And I was very strongly impacted by some of the events that were happening around me when I was young. And I had a variety of choices of what to do. And at some point when I was at the monastery, I decided that if I was going to respond to the suffering, I wanted to be able to respond at the depth of where human suffering, the depth of where you can make the most difference in human suffering. And when I was young, a young Buddhist practitioner at the monastery, I felt that it was the attachment to self, self-clinging at the root of the human psyche, which is the suffering that really needs to be addressed if somehow we're going to be able to respond to the deepest forms of suffering that humans have. And the only way I knew how to do that was through Buddhist practice. And so I felt, well, if I can do this myself and then be a supporter of other people to practice, so they can do it for themselves, that then at least I know my life is dedicated to responding to suffering and what I felt was the deepest roots of suffering in human life. And that became the motivating force in my life. You know, all the decisions in my life after that, major decisions in my life, were somehow oriented around that kind of response. In a sense, that's what's brought me here to IMC, because of that decision. And my sincere hope is the practice we do here is a response to human suffering and to try to make a difference for all the people who come, but also to all the people who we touch in the way that we act in the world from the way that we've purified our hearts. Part of the motivation to practice and part of the value of practice is to be able to turn the mirror around to look at ourselves, to understand really well how we tick, how we respond, how we react, so that when there are challenges, we know ourselves well enough to understand how we get anxious, how we get afraid, how we get horrified, and how that maybe limits us, or how that is not so useful, or how to work with that, how not to let horror, our own horror, our own fear, get in the way of our ability to respond to the situation. One of the common questions that people ask on retreat is, because when people sit on meditation retreats, if you sit and meditate hour after hour, day after day, sooner or later, and some people think it's sooner, their knees will hurt or their back will hurt. And then people ask, why should I sit with painful knees? Why should I sit with the painful backs? Why not, you know, get up and move or go do something else? And you certainly need a lot of wisdom to know when to sit with physical pain or emotional pain on retreat and when to do something to change it. But if we only pull away from our difficulties, our challenges, the pain and the emotional difficulties, do we need to turn it up louder? Is it here okay, everyone? I see one person cupping her ear. So maybe up a little bit. Can we do it a little bit? If we only learn how to be free when we're comfortable, we're not really free. And so to have a situation where we're uncomfortable and then to work with it until we find our freedom and our peace with the discomfort is a very important part of a realistic spiritual practice. If you're only trying to find your peace by getting rid of the discomfort, only when this is gone, then I'll have a spiritual life, then I think it's not realistic. Human life will have discomfort, from the mild ones to the great tragic ones. And then knowing how to be free or how to be at peace or how to be not overwhelmed by those situations is part of the function of learning, is part of what the practice is supposed to do for us. So as we sit on retreat or sit here even, and our knee hurts or our back hurts or we have a headache or we're feeling some kind of, you know, uncomfortable emotion, to learn to see that's a very important arena for developing our spiritual life and developing our mind. To really understand, to be convinced about that and have a willingness to face it and be present for it. Not to feel it's a mistake, not to feel like you have to get rid of it, but what is it like to be free in the presence of physical pain or emotional pain? It can happen. I think it's appropriate to feel heartfelt pain when we encounter a tragedy like the earthquake and the tsunami. I can't imagine that someone like the Buddha would not have felt pain. You know, you look at the Buddha and usually he's sitting there shining and peaceful and has a smile on his face. And, you know, could you imagine someone like that, you know, sitting up in a tree on the beaches of Sri Lanka, watching everything around him, just sitting there with a smile on his face and feeling, you know, his peace and delight and bliss? I don't think it's human. It's unreal. It would be inhuman to do that. I think it breaks the heart. But how do we allow the breaking of the heart to be useful? How do we allow the breaking of the heart to be something which then helps us, motivate us to respond in a greater way? Michael Lerner, who's a Jewish teacher, Jewish rabbi, I think, when people ask the question, where is God? And since he's a, you know, theist, that's a kind of, you know, it's his department. He says, oh, that's not a useful question. The important question is where is humanity? That's the question you should be asking. Where is humanity? And so where is our humanity? And humanity means where is our response? Michael Lerner also says that his definition of God is it's the forces of healing and transformation in human beings. So that's kind of an interesting idea of God. I never heard of that before. I don't know if anybody thinks about that, but Michael Lerner calls God the force of healing and transformation in the human psyche. Or in the universe, comes to that. And so then you start getting closer to, you know, some things that a Buddhist might say. That in Buddhism, there's no God, but the forces of healing, the forces of transformation, the forces of goodness that reside in our individual hearts is where humanity resides. And so it's not a matter of asking why tragedy happens. I don't think Buddhists are so interested in asking why, except in ways that are directly helpful. You don't want to ask God, about God or karma and all that. But rather, the important question is how do we respond to it? Not why did it happen, but how do we respond? Given that it's happened, how do we respond? And if, as I said before, if there is no response, I think there's no spiritual life. There's no way of taking care of our own hearts. And then one way is the internal way of looking at our own hearts, our own minds, and trying to clarify that to the hearts of the root of it, to try to find the deepest or the highest forms of spiritual truth that are possible. The other is the external response. And there's a different kind of stirring or trembling of the heart that motivates this external response. And this is called, in Pali, anukampa. It's usually the word, the most common word for compassion or for sympathy. And kampa means also kind of stirring, trembling. And when the heart is open and receptive, then there's sympathy, there's compassionate response in the natural heart, in the open heart. And so then how do we respond? Do we allow ourselves to respond? Are we expecting other people to respond? Do we get angry because our president doesn't seem to respond well enough? You know, it's up to him to do something. I think to be looking externally, to looking towards others, certainly important evaluations in the next election, remember that. But rather than looking externally, what are other people doing? And why aren't other people doing enough? I think the important question is, are you doing enough? What can you do? I've been very inspired by the degree to which people all over the world, individuals and corporations, business, have responded. I think the last figure I saw was $322 million have been contributed in the United States by non-governmental sources. So individuals and businesses and nonprofits, that's a lot of money. However, it's a lot of money, but it's also only 40% of what the same category of people donated after 9/11, which was a huge outpouring of support at that time. And maybe we felt it more at home. You know, it happened to us much more closely, so it makes sense maybe to donate more. But it doesn't make sense. Does what's happened in Sri Lanka, is it any less what happens to us than what happens in New York? Can we take it in a way that really makes us, you know, want to respond at least as much as 9/11 caused us to respond? You remember the story of the four whips, the four horses? You know, when it's in a distant village, the person who responds is like the well-trained horse, just sees the whip of the shadow of the whip. In the last week, the United Nations came out with a report that every day 29,000 children die unnecessarily. That's 10 million children a year. And we have, you know, maybe a million people, hundreds of thousands of people dying in Sudan, Uganda, and all over the world. The scale of human tragedy is going on all the time. You know, the scale of what happened in the Indian Ocean is not something that's happening just every once in a while, but it's something that's happening constantly, all the time. What does it mean to take that in and allow oneself to be moved by that? Or would we rather not be moved by that? Would we rather kind of shut off and not pay attention to it? My feeling is that to be free, which is freedom, is one of the key, to be liberated is one of the key motivations for spirit Buddhist practice. To be free is to be open to be moved by that. If you don't want to be moved, don't become free. You know, stay closed, stay resistant, stay hidden, stay afraid. But if you want to become free, then allow yourself to be moved. Take these things in. Part of the question in Buddhism is not, where is God, but where are you? And when you ask, where are you, in Buddhism, we ask the question, who am I? And then, as most of you know, Buddhism says, there is no self. Very simplistically, you can say, you're nothing. Very simplistically. You are nothing means that who we are is someone who responds. Someone who doesn't hold themselves separate from or distinct from the needs of the world around them. Whether it's the neighbors, immediate neighbors, or your family, or your community, or people far away. So to allow oneself to be moved by what happened, each of you will be moved in your own way, and I have no idea of how individuals should be motivated or act in response to being moved. I know that some people are moved to really understand themselves better because the degree of horror and anguish they feel is so strong that they feel that this is really important to come to grips with this, to deal with this. And so they maybe turn to something like spiritual practice or meditation practice in order to really clarify the nature of their own anguish. And that's really necessary for some people. Other people are moved in other ways. Maybe to practice internally, where they clarify the nature of the self. Who am I? Other people are moved to respond, to go to the beaches, or to send money, or to send whatever. Or perhaps we don't send money or support to people far away, but the impact of what happens far away still motivates us, and it motivates us to help in our local community more. I think I'll do a better job here to try to help. It's not possible to respond to every tragedy in the world, but it's possible to allow every tragedy in the world to motivate us to give strength to the ways in which we want to respond locally and the ways we want to respond. So again, for myself, I don't know if it's so good to talk about myself here, but one of the things that I see the tragedies of the world, and there's a lot of things I don't choose to respond to, but I'm motivated by that. It's really important for me that I'm impacted by that. And one of the ways I try to channel that is to try to do a better job teaching, because I feel that one of the ways of responding to suffering for me is to try to teach and offer practice opportunities for people in order to kind of deal with this. So I channel it in this way the best I can. So to find a way of responding. So that today, this talk's, I'm going to stop now, but it was really my attempt to try to say something that might be useful or helpful for our community here. I have no idea if I succeeded because I don't know. You know, I really don't know how to respond to a situation like this. It was so big, you know, I don't know. And I don't know how it really impacts, you know, the depths of everybody's hearts. I mean, it's hard, really hard to know. It's such a big thing. I probably don't even know how it's impacted myself and my own heart, let alone the rest of you. There's so much I feel I don't know about this. And so, but if any of you would like to say something, have comments to make, or it would be nice. Yes? I'm going to pass the mic, yeah.
I think it's important to offer another interpretation of the four horses that it's the one that they give in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. But in that version, the fourth horse is is the one that goes to the village, because the fourth horse has been so penetrated by pain that when it happens, even thousands of miles away, they understand the perturbation in their spirit. And so I only bring that up because I think it's like, well, A, the people in the Indian Ocean are the fourth horse right now, whether they like it or not. They're penetrated.
Right.
And B, for practitioners that have maybe have that way where they really have to get it beaten out of them before they're ready to get serious, that it's okay that, I mean, Suzuki Roshi's story makes it okay that you're the bad horse, the fourth horse, that just is stubborn and won't learn, but then it's easier to feel pain for other people.
Uh-huh. So when we're the fourth horse, when pain and suffering comes closest to us, that is the kind of that conditions us in a sense to be able to understand other people better, kind of gives birth to us. You know, so this idea of spiritual great spiritual leaders who lost their parent as a child, that's pretty, you know, that's like the fourth horse, and that gives birth to a greater capacity for compassion, understanding, than understanding suffering in the abstract. Yeah, thank you. I think that for some people, the magnitude of such a thing like this makes it impossible to respond for a while, maybe for a long time. But rather, they have to just kind of sit and kind of manage with their own feelings because they're so strong, and sit with them and work with them. And yeah.
I wasn't on. How's that? I was actually sitting last Sunday in Hawaii with those two teachers. And I think you're right. The magnitude of this filters down in different ways. One thing that came up in the sit afterward was, what does one do? You know, what if one wants to donate money or do something? Like Steve was in Thailand. Steve Smith, and that came up in Franz and so forth. But Steve Armstrong knows somebody in Sri Lanka, a villager, and there's quite a bit of fishing, you know, people that lost their whole livelihoods and so forth and so on. And one thing that we did there was we put a bowl up to have people donate to buy one villager one boat.
Nice.
And because there were connections there, we were able to get that money to that person and say, here, go buy a boat, you know. Because part of it is, well, where's this money going? You know, you donate the money and it goes to administration, or, you know, is it actually getting? And I think part of the problem now is distribution. How do these things get to people in need? So it just, I haven't been here for about a month, so I didn't know if anybody had created something like that, or maybe through your connections or somebody in those parts of the country that has somebody specifically locally that we can send a little donation from our sangha that might.
We haven't. I mean, you know, Brigitte was here last Sunday. She put out a basket for Sarvodaya.
Right.
And Sarvodaya is a Buddhist group in Sri Lanka that helps with a lot of good work.
Right.
And and I was wondering about that coming down here today, whether we should do something. And it just seems to me, that the you know, I don't myself personally don't have a personal connection with any place, and the addresses and organizations are all over everywhere. It's so easy to find good places to donate to. And my hope is that people will do it. My assumption is people who want to will easily find ways to do it themselves, and it doesn't have to be channeled through IMC. But if that's a useful thing to do, I'm really happy with that idea too.
There's been quite a few suggestions put on the email list too, which has been really nice.
So on the email list, there are suggestions for Yes.
For those of us who work in grief and death, I can just remind us that the first natural step that you can't intellectually prevent is shock and numbness. And for those who have had any other stressors in the last year or two, any other stressors, there's a cumulative effect. So I often ask myself, what's my response when I'm in shock and numb? Not that I shouldn't be there. It's just the natural human way. Maybe it's different if you're 100% enlightened. I don't know personally about that. And I remember the first two steps that I just this weekend read about stress reduction, which fits in shock and numb. You need a lot of extra care and warmth and kindness and slow down until you can get out of shock and numb, and then you can act differently. But these first two steps I remember were move the body. So shock and numb, we could just get so stuck. And narrow the focus. So instead of trying to do something for the whole thing, you know, one boat, it fits into that. Yes. And I'm in shock and numb, and I forgot the third step. I'll work on the first two.
Not sure exactly what I want to say. I guess I have trouble with this catastrophe and the huge response to it when there's so many other catastrophes that have no response, you know. And so that is very difficult for me with, I guess you said 10 million children die all the time. We have what happened in Rwanda, what happened in, you know, in Darfur. We have the deforestation, the clear cutting of the Sierra Nevada. We have the species that are disappearing. We have global warming. It just feels overwhelming to me that the terrible things that are happening, and then I think about all this outpouring for one event when there's so many that go unanswered. So I guess that's my feeling.
Thank you. So for me also, I think that one of the reflections I have is that it's important to remember this, that all these tragedies, whether this one or others, they actually continue a lot longer after they're out of the news. And that'll be many, many years that people are deeply impacted by the earthquake and tsunami. And that, in my own family, you know, we're still impacted in very deep ways by what happened in World War II 60 years ago. And so things go on for decades. And so I think it's very important that in taking care of ourselves, taking care of the world, taking care of situations, we're also preparing for the future. So it's not just simply taking care of the people right now, but also we're taking care of people in 10, 20 years, depending on how well we respond to all the different places that children who grow up with this poverty and the difficulties, depending on how the world responds and the opportunities they have, it's going to very deeply affect the kind of person they grew up to become, and whether they become someone who are forces of good in the world or forces of increasing the strife and conflict in the world depends a lot on their opportunities as they grow up. They live in poverty and produces a different kind of person than if you grow up, without poverty. So I hope, for me, it's important to remember that, it's important to remember not to forget, and that that these things go on, and the world requires us to respond. And that as we work through our own existential situation, that hopefully it'll make us a responder, people who respond, and that that becomes a source of refuge for us, source of a part of our well-being, is taking refuge in our ability to respond, independent of how impossible it is, the situation. In the Mahayana tradition, they have the idea of the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva is someone who responds to suffering even though it's impossible to help at all. There was one person who lived by the bodhisattva ideal who loved Frank Sinatra's song, the Impossible, Live the Impossible Dream, because it's impossible to help completely. But to make the effort, take refuge in our ability to respond, rather than taking refuge in our fear, I think is really important. So you all now know a new Buddhist word, samvega. Just to have your heart tremble and be stirred by the suffering of the world. So thank you all very much, and please take good care of yourselves.